Welcome to the Unified Brand Podcast, brought to you by Elements Brand Management, a weekly podcast to empower founders, marketers, and business professionals to brand smarter, not harder, and build impactful, memorable, and differentiated brands that stand out from the competition. So today we're joined by Melina Palmer, globally celebrated keynote speaker and CEO of the Brainy business, helping great brands and the people within them do greater things by leveraging the power of behavioral economics. She's also the host of the podcast, The Brainy Business, Understanding the Psychology of Why People Buy, which has been downloaded in over 170 countries worldwide. And you also have a number of books, including What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You, and your latest book, The Truth About Pricing, How to Apply Behavioral Economics to Customers Buy. Great to have you back on the Unified Brand Podcast. We spoke back in, I think it was July last year, and it was episode 124. So it'd be good to refresh the audience about self, what you do, and potentially a brief introduction to behavioral economics.
For sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Delighted to be back. As you said, my name is Melina Palmer, and my work is in applied behavioral economics, which is essentially just understanding why people do the things they do and buy the things they buy, so we can better communicate with others, whether that's getting customers to buy, employees to buy in, or even understanding ourselves a little bit better in the way that we communicate and get things done. So yeah, behavioral economics, the super basic way to say it. I always like to just say that if, you know, traditional economics and psychology had a baby, you'd have behavioral economics. And it's this balance of humans and how they really make decisions instead of how we think that they should, and being able to communicate in a way that makes it easier for people to do business with you or buy in on whatever ideas that you're selling, and just understanding how the brain really works.
Cool. And then with the new book, it's a focus on pricing. So I was going to ask, one of the things I was sort of thinking about was, why do people buy? And you said there's a difference a lot of times between how we perceive things to be and how it actually happens. So why do people buy, and how does pricing affect people in different ways? Be a question.
Yeah. So the thing about pricing, and so as you said, the title of the book is The Truth About Pricing. And I give away that answer, I think, on page 4 of the book. It says, like, the truth is, you know, price isn't about the price. It's not about that number on the tag. All the things that happen before the price matter more than the price itself, that actual number that we get to. And all the stuff that comes before are things that people don't think about as much as they should. They don't even know that they should think about these things and the value that comes from that understanding of psychology and how it can be properly applied into a brand. And so the book, The Truth About Pricing, is helping to understand all the stuff that comes before the price and gives different questions to ask and things to think about as someone in business, so that you can build that out for your company in a way that's going to align well in the mind of that consumer. So with this, the reason, you know, this book, I think, was important, the reason I wanted to write the book and why I focused on pricing specifically, is because what I've come to find over the years is everyone hates pricing. It is something that in business, just the idea of doing it, it's so easy to put off for tomorrow. Like, you know, it's important. You feel this weight of, like, if I don't get this right, everything could go wrong. And so it's easy to put in that, like, next week, tomorrow, 2 weeks from now camp, and just keep putting it off until one day you wake up and go, oh no, like, the launch is on Friday and we haven't done it yet. And say, we haven't figured out the price. We'll just grab something, you know, we just pull something out of the air that's the price we're going to use, which is often some version of, like, a dollar less than our competitors or some percentage markup on our expenses. And then in 6 months, once we get through the launch, then we'll really revisit and consider the pricing in a more proper way. And we know what happens then, right? We keep not doing the thing. But properly planned pricing that you and the team can be confident in is so, so key in converting sales and helping people to feel good about doing business with you and buying whatever it is that you're selling. And so this book is as close to the just do it for me sort of mentality I know that a lot of people, especially in small business, are in when it comes to pricing. And it's, you know, the same process we go through with our clients of the questions to ask, things to think, stuff to know about before you get to that final price, and then how to present it.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, there's so many people that I can think of off the top of my head that I've spoken to in terms of from an entrepreneurial perspective that struggle with pricing. It becomes personal. It becomes attached to them. It's sort of almost a marker on how good they think they are and kind of ties to that rather than the kind of value they're potentially bringing. Is that something that you see a lot of with individuals, but also businesses, I think, sometimes hold themselves back potentially from pricing certain levels because they feel, like you said, it's always what the competition are doing. How do we fit into this? How do we compete? That kind of thing. So have you come across things like that?
For sure. And especially as you said, in that service-based business, it's really easy to get in your own head about what this says about your like personal worth and like value ties in. And if someone says no, you take that really personally. And it's scary to step up to that next space because you don't want someone to tell you that they're not willing to pay it. But again, if you're really hedging in the way you present it, it doesn't necessarily mean the price is wrong. You spoke about it in a way that made that person not feel good about the idea of buying. You primed them into thinking like, something's off here. Like, if you don't believe it, why would I believe it? Right. Yeah. So that comes across in those, you know, oh, well, the package is $25,000. And like, oh, I know that feels like a lot. And so if you're feeling a little bit hesitant about it, like, I get it. And, you know, I mean, we did just raise the prices. And so if you need a discount, like, we can work our way in and blah, 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 blah. Like, you didn't even give them a chance to react before you hedged with all this stuff. Of course, they don't feel confident in it, right? Whereas if you say it with really clear confidence, it just feels very different on that other side. And so when it comes to understanding that value, like you said, the other thing that people often don't realize or forget, it's easy to forget, that you are not your own best customer most of the time. You're not your target market. Because if you needed the thing that you've been able to build a company around, you wouldn't have been able to create the solution anyway. And so, like for those in a marketing space, myself included, we really underestimate how difficult it is for other people to even do a baseline of marketing type communication and brand work. They just, it's really, really, really hard for them. And even if they were to spend ages of time, they would just never get to what it is that we're able to do. And so it's not necessarily about the hours it took you. It's about the value it's going to provide them and the sales they're going to get, the time that they get back. You know, same with like an accountant, right? Like, I don't want to do my own numbers and taxes and that sort of stuff because it would take me a really, really long time. But if I outsource that out to somebody else who can do it quickly, I don't care if it takes them an hour or 10 hours. If it saves me 20 hours of time, that's valuable to me, right? Because I'm able to repurpose that into something else.
Yeah, that's an interesting example because I've had something recently with an accountant where the value they brought to something that was the other stuff they did on top of the things that they actually provide, if that makes sense. So kind of in terms of the way they made me feel, the way they kind of were there, the way they answered questions and guided me through things has made me value that interaction more than just what they did as well. And I find that sometimes with clients that work with us, when we go through a branding process, the knock-on effect is some things you don't think about before you quantify things like price. So things like you inspire them as a team or you motivate them or, you know, it allows them to achieve certain goals. Those sort of things are hard to put a price on or a value on. So from your perspective, when you think about pricing or helping people to think about the idea of pricing something, what things do you think about, what do you look at, and how do you sort of approach that?
There are lots of things, but one of the pieces that I was thinking about as you were talking is this value in being able to take a step back and kind of get out of your own way. So in the book, The Truth About Pricing, part one is just kind of talking about the importance of psychology, understanding how our brains really work. That part one of all my books does that, right? That's the goal up front. And then we've got some bulk kind of learning in the middle, like things that we need to be able to understand, that we want to be aware of, that we want to be thinking about. And then we have some of this applying it and putting it all together at part three. That's sort of the flow that all my books have. In the case with The Truth About Pricing, there are six chapters in this middle section, part two, that are the different areas that you need to be thinking about, questions you want to be asking. And it starts in what might be a surprising place. So we get to, of course, thinking about your customers, thinking about the offer, questions about your company, eventually getting to the numbers. But the first chapter there is you, because as I've sort of been alluding to here, you are the biggest potential hindrance, and that's a collective you of an organization, into how much you can price and whether or not people are going to buy in and the structure of how you set things up. We put ourselves and our companies in these boxes that don't have to exist. And when we do, you know, tighten up and say, well, people only want to buy from us in this way, or we have to have the model be like this because everyone else is doing it this way. We're a herding species, right? So we're looking to others for how we can do stuff. If you do that, those barriers are not necessarily true, right? And you're just setting yourself in this space that you don't have to be contained within. So taking that time to step back and say, over here, what if it looked like this? And it might be to say, we can't charge more than this number. No one would ever invest more than this. Or even going the other way, it's not all about raising prices. It might be like, there's no way to get value if we reduce the price. We couldn't make it work. Anytime you have that kind of vibe, the feeling of we've always done it or we have to do it this way because, taking the step back and kind of getting out of your own way is really important. May I give an example of the grilled cheese sandwiches?
Definitely. Yes.
One of my favorite examples from the book, I would say. And so in this case, we think about making grilled cheese sandwich, right? So even people that can't cook, you would be able to say, like, you could probably eat together a grilled cheese, right? It's doable for pretty much anybody. And so if that's something you're going to make, you're going to get the ingredients for it, like $1 maybe to make one, right? We know what goes into it. It's pretty basic. But if you imagine, you know, you're out, you're craving a grilled cheese, you really want one, you know, what's the most that you would spend, be willing to like invest in buying yourself that grilled cheese sandwich?
Yes, it depends on where you go, I think. But yeah, probably, I don't know, $15, $20, something like that, $25, something like that.
Yep. It's so interesting where some people are like, I mean, $10 maybe, right? And then sometimes we get in that 20, 15, 25, right? That's pretty standard what I hear from people. But that's like the best grilled cheese ever, right? So listener, you know what number you were at, where you were feeling reasonable there. There's a restaurant in New York City. It's called Serendipity 3, and they have a $214 grilled cheese sandwich on their menu.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And people buy it, right? Not everybody, not all day. And it's the job there is not to be the flagship item that everyone is buying every single day, right? But it sets up this feeling, right? So when I say there's a $200 grilled cheese, and it's important to 214, right? We're like up above in this way, that you go, well, what's all the fuss about? Like, I want to try and see what's going on with this sandwich, right? That if I was visiting New York, would I want to go pop over there, check it out? And even if you don't get that sandwich, you're maybe going to post on social media, say you're here, and maybe you're going to pick up one of the $35 sandwiches that they have on their menu or something else that's even above what you might have gotten, but it's to be like part of the experience. You want to share, you want to be a part of it, right? And so that, again, that $214 sandwich, its job isn't to be bought all the time, but it's helping the entire experience of the brand to stand out. They also have $200 French fries. They have a $1,000 vanilla sundae on their menu. The French fries were something that they introduced. These are all Guinness World Record holding items that they have on their menu. So it is for PR purposes, but there's nothing wrong with that, right? Because it's saying something about their brand. When they were coming back out of COVID, they created those French fries to be able to announce that they were opening back up. And there was an 8 to 10 week waiting list for these $200 fries. So that's another thing. They're scarce because it's very special ingredients that go in, like in the grilled cheese sandwich, it's special cheese from this region that's like only a certain number of cows in the world that produce this milk, and they graze on wild strawberry and licorice, and it's got gold leaf in the in the crust, and they make it with Dom Perignon. It's like a whole scene, right? It's a whole thing. And again, that's really the point. And it's not even the most expensive grilled cheese sandwich that anyone has ever bought. So just to like keep pushing our brains a little bit further, right? So some listening may remember the Virgin Mary grilled cheese, which made headlines you know, it's been decades now, but back on eBay. So there was a woman who made a grilled cheese sandwich, took a bite, and then looked down at her sandwich and realized, Virgin Mary is in the grilled cheese sandwich, right? So she sees the Virgin Mary and puts this in a box, a clear container that she leaves on her nightstand with cotton balls in it, and says that for 10 years, didn't get a speck of mold, this like divine sandwich that's sitting on her nightstand. And eventually she decided to sell it on eBay, of which it went for, I think, $28,000 and had 38 bids to get it to that point, right? Not everyone is buying a $28,000 sandwich, let alone one that's been sitting around for a decade. But like, you don't need everyone to buy. You need one person to buy that really expensive thing, right? You need a very small sampling. And they had, you know, 38 bids that got it to that point. And so understanding what you're about, how you can go all in if you are going to be selling those $200 sandwiches or whatever that is, to know that the limits really are self-contained, can help open up a lot of opportunities around brands and businesses and how you're going to set up your prices.
Are you struggling to grow your brand but not sure why? Has your business hit a growth ceiling, or is your marketing failing to land with your target audience? At Elements Brand Management, we've put together a 4-minute brand power assessment that will score your brand in a percentage out of 100 and highlight the key areas that are holding your business back. Visit brandpowerscore.co.uk today, take the assessment, and unlock your business's full potential. That's really cool. I was thinking that I remember seeing something where a guy in the UK who kind of does a lot of food programs went to Japan, and he found this guy who had these strawberries, and they were kind of the most expensive strawberries in the world. And he tried it. I think it was like £100, $100 a strawberry. And he bit into the strawberry and he just said it was the most, he's like this chef guy, and he said it's the most amazing thing he'd ever tasted. It was the most strawberry-like strawberry thing he'd ever tasted. It's been this the most amazing thing. And I always find it interesting because what you said there about the grilled cheese sandwich and then the other things you try on the menu, I bet the other things on the menu you try end up being amazing. And there's a thing to do with, they're probably really good, but we almost increase our experience of the thing because the price is higher. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. Our brains get what they expect. Mm-hmm. And so if you have been primed with the idea that this is going to be amazing and you're really excited about it, is something that's going to draw you in more, and you're like hyper aware and focusing on all the stuff to live up to that expectation you've set. Of course, if it was terrible, right, there's a kind of the other side where we're really going to fall far and be outraged in a way. I talk about surprise and delight more in my first book, What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You, and how it ties in with dopamine. And so if we've set a really high expectation that this is the greatest thing, and then it's like sewage, there's a real outrage that comes on the other side of this. So we want to be thoughtful to that, of course. But when we have that expectation of what it's going to be, and we're part of the whole, like I said, the vibe, the experience of it, and also it just shapes how we feel. So in the Brainy Business podcast, in the second ever episode of the show, I talked about something. It was the top 5 wording mistakes businesses make. And one of the examples that I use there that has now, it's like something that people still will tag me when this particular item comes back around every year, because it's a very seasonal item. So there's some scarcity with it. And at the time, it didn't exist in the UK, but it's come out now. And so when that first came out a couple of years ago, people started tagging me, and they're called cotton candy grapes. And okay. So in the UK, they're fairy floss. And when we think about something like grapes, like talk about a commoditized industry, right? Like, do I care what farm my grapes came from? And it's sort of like a grape is a grape is a grape, right? Like the choices I have are green or purple, seedless or not. And like, who's buying seeded grapes? Yuck. Like, we don't want that. So like, that's not really a choice. So there's not much going on there, right? But there's this company that invested in making hybrid grapes, and they're not infusing anything, like no chemicals or anything. They're just looking at all these, like, you know, different varietals of grape and merging them together to come up with these extra sweet, delicious grapes. And this person decided that they reminded them of cotton candy. When they went around and sold them, they've got big pink, you know, cotton candy imagery on them. And they really stand out from the other grapes in the supermarket when you go to buy them. And it's because they have a hint, it's kind of like vanilla-y flavor, right? But we think about if they would have been like called super sweet grapes or vanilla grapes or birthday cake grapes or cotton candy grapes. Like when you look at that and you see cotton candy grapes, you go, well, I want to try that. And like, let's all try some and see what they're like, right? And the thing is, they are expensive. And they sell out almost instantly. There's actually a website, it's called cottoncandygrapewatch.com, that when people find them, they're like, oh my gosh, here's the picture. They've arrived at Costco, and everybody run to get them before they're gone because they only like come out one time a year. But again, if they were just called extra sweet grapes, like meh, I'm not as intrigued as something like cotton candy. And then when I taste it, I'm going to say, oh, it is like cotton candy. Oh my gosh, right? And we're all part of it. Like, did you taste the cotton candy? Did you? It becomes a whole experience because it's so well thought out and it's priming for the person that's going to be tasting. And then you want to share about it, which is a really key item.
Yeah, I remember a story of about Julius Caesar. I think it's true, but I don't know if it's entirely true. But I think it's where this idea of, it's called the Veblen effect, comes from. But basically, he was kind of, when he was a low-level senator or a low-level politician, he kind of got picked up by pirates. Kind of taken hostage and taken off to an island, basically. And they wrote off a hostage demand to the kind of the Roman Senate or whatever it was at the time. And before they sent it off, told them to increase the price, the ransom demand, to increase the price and the ransom demand. Mm-hmm. So they put this massive figure. The news got back to Rome and everyone's like, who's this Julius Caesar? Who is he? But why is he worth so much? And basically they ended up paying it. He came back and he had notoriety because he'd got them to increase his price to make him more wanted, which is really interesting. So on that side of things, but when it comes to sales, we have the company in the UK that does sales all the time. They're literally constantly sales. And I used to work at a place where it was constant, one sale to the next, to the next, to the next. And I always thought from the brand perspective, this can't be great. You know, this can't be great. What signals are you giving to people? So what are your thoughts on that side of things, like on the constant sales side of things, or just constantly reducing prices and stuff like that?
So in the truth about pricing, like I said, there are lots of questions and things to consider and items I put like tasks through the book to help you get to your ultimate price and how you present it. One of the things that I would say is quite possibly the most important decision that you're going to make is knowing what type of business you are. And this is not service or product based. It's not in person or online. It is knowing whether your business is built on quality or value. And I know you're saying like, I want both. Like quality and value are good things. I want both of those things. And you can't, right? Like you have to pick a lane here because the way that you go to implement different aspects of the psychology, even if we're working on the same concepts, you should do them in different ways based on which side you choose to be on. And when you're in that gray area is when it gets confusing for those potential customers. It's hard for them to buy from you. So let me define them and then should help to answer some of the question as well. So the quality side, these are your, you know, if you're selling to celebrities, luxury items, if you have special certifications, if you're doing really sustainably built models, if you're investing in research and development, like any of these sort of areas where we want to be at this era of quality and typically higher prices than what we would see in the competition. In this side, you can still be providing good value for that, right? So it doesn't have to be exorbitant for no reason. But you are really focused on providing good quality. And when you think about investing money back in the brand or the business, it's going to be done in a different way than if you were wanting to be a discount, a bargain, a deal for someone. And so on that side, for a quality business, I recommend you have whole number pricing for one thing, $500 instead of $497, or even in the case of Serendipity 3, right, being 214. Like we're up above in a way that you go, huh, Like, that's interesting, right? It's not rounded down. So that is our quality side of things. On the value side, and then quality shouldn't be running lots of discounts and sales and deals and things like that. You can choose to do them every so often, very rarely, and really have a reason behind it, right? So, and if you choose not to, then that's totally fine. But where we get into the kind of murky gray area with that type of business is, say, you know, it's the holidays. Like you said, you're about quality. You look around, everyone's doing a year-end sale, and you try to throw something together because, well, that's what we're supposed to do right now. And so you make something up and you have this weird discount that totally misaligns with what the company is about, and it just degrades in a way that's not helpful for you. So making the decision when you're in a cold state outside of that moment and say, we know that we're going to feel this pull at the end of the year because other people are doing this, and we can say now we don't do that, but what might we do instead, right? We could have it be saying, hey, there are only 3 spots left, right? We're going to leverage scarcity in this, or we only have, or maybe you're giving a free gift with something, but that's not the same as a discount, right? So looking at how you frame and position things differently is important. So then we get on the value side, which of course is those bargains, the deals, the discounts. You're going to round down your pricing. This is your Costco, your Walmart. Great business models are had on this side. And of course, you can still sell quality items, but the value to people is still at the core. And like, if you had simple websites, I like to talk about Costco in this way too, right? So simple on the luxury side, if you go to like the Cartier website or something, it's simple luxury of like they invested in making it feel super simple, right? And you can tell they spent a lot of money in that whole experience. And when you're in person, it's plush and all of this luxury vibe. Costco's website is really simple in a like, we didn't waste money on that. It works. It's getting you what you need, but we're not investing in that. We're also not investing in big ads. We're not investing in cushy experience. It's a warehouse, right? And you feel like it's a warehouse when you're in there. But that says something about the brand without them having to say it in this like verbal way. And because they've owned that space so well, you know, when you go to buy something, you're not going and checking like cost of like what it would be. You're not price matching to other competitors when you're shopping at Costco in a way you might at another retailer, because you just believe that they have your best interest at heart and that they're doing what they can for those members. And so that brand message lives on in a way that like, don't worry, Costco makes plenty of money. They have some loss leaders, like their rotisserie chickens. They lose $30 to $40 million a year keeping the rotisserie chicken at $4.99, and they lose a ton of money on their $1.50 hot dog combos. But those are really key in the overarching vibe of the brand and feeling that value to where you're willing to, you know, buy and spend a little bit more somewhere else. So again, you can do discounts, you can have good sales, you can be doing that, but be thoughtful about it and make sure it aligns with if you've decided to be a value brand. And if you are on the quality side, be really, 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 really selective and always would ask, should we run a sale? We feel like we need to, but what if we didn't? What might we do instead? Again, asking those thoughtful questions is really the most important thing you can be doing all along the way, especially when you feel like you have to do something.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think I always think about the idea of congruence with brand communications. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there with the kind of Costco example of being congruent in terms of who they are, what they're trying to get across, and that kind of thing. And then obviously on the values, on the quality side as well, a similar kind of vibe. And we've never done any sort of sale things, so I always feel that it could devalue the brand from our perspective and what we do. But there is something that I've always thought, you can add in extra things potentially rather than take stuff away. So like you said, you could add a gift, or potentially you could add in something that is another level of value that potentially adds to the value of what you already have rather than taking away. But so what are some top tips you can give the listeners in terms of how to improve their pricing?
Well, Of course, we want to be more thoughtful to what we're looking at. We want to know what type of business we are. We want to make sure that you know who your customer is. So, and I think in this case, another place where people have a tendency to misstep is we know that we could help everyone, and it's really easy to get sucked into this idea of all these people you could help if only, right? But if they realized, then we could whatever, right? When you're in that, like, everyone, and you heard where we said about, like, you know, you have to niche down. You've heard it. I get it. And, like, brain-wise, like, it's really true, because if we don't see ourselves in the story and people can't, like, effectively self-select in and often more importantly out, it has an impact of how the entire working relationship is going to go. So for you, just think about all the time that gets wasted in considering and, like, having discovery calls, and maybe you're doing a pitch, and we've all had the moment in a project or something and you realize this is not a good fit, right? We have the client that it's something we shouldn't have done. And you look back and think, you know, like, the signs were there and I forced it to make it fit. I did the different version of the model because they asked me to do this thing and I figured we could do it. Like, I made the exception. I did the thing. And you come around on the other side and say, why did I do that? And because, like, in the moment, you want to be able to help everyone. So taking the time to consider who you're a fit for and who you are not, and having those lines in the sand to where you're able to say, you know, if somebody says, well, can't we do it this other way? And we can say, I hear you. And we don't do it like that because of this. And, like, know that not everyone is going to be your customer. And that's okay. Whether it's based on the type of work you're wanting to do, the price point that you're at, like, when you can get to a place where you know who you're for and the value you provide to them, and you can communicate that clearly, one, if it's out on your website, people will read that and go, yikes, that's not us. You never have to talk to them. And that's, like, nothing on them. That's great, right? But, like, that saves you so much time. And the people that do get it are, like, so all in and excited to come work with you and your way of doing things. And they're on board, right? I'm ready. You show me what I need to do. That's just such a better experience to have. So let's say, you know, really taking the time to own who you're for and who you're not, and making that clear is something where it makes it easier for people to buy in. The other thing is really knowing that numbers have a huge impact. And there's a concept in behavioral science known as anchoring. And like, the numbers we use, and it ties in with something called relativity. And I'm sure I talked about this when I was on the show before, but I don't remember specifically. But in this case, when we put out a number or something, our brains get really anchored on whatever that first thing was. So whenever you're talking about your pricing, don't start low and work your way up. And whatever you really want people to buy in general should not be the most expensive thing that you offer. So when you're building out, say, a package for someone doing the proposal, you work your way up and say, well, this is the best thing. And then you stop and you don't make something even bigger than that. And then when you introduce them, you're like, well, here's option A and B, and then you really should have C. And we've been, like, getting more and more expensive in the process. And, like, you anchored them on something really, really low. So they, by the time we get to that $50,000 project, but if you started by saying, well, there's this $10,000 option, and then we have this $28,000 option that's really good, but you should have this $50,000 thing, go, ew, like, no, that sounds like a lot. I'm going to do the 10, right? That sounds better to me. Whereas if we go the other way and we had built something that's a great option, I talk about it as, you know, you want to know what your best offer is, make sure it's something that's a really good deal for someone. You're going to be happy about doing the work and it's profitable for you. We've built that out. Know why it's a good value and then give it a wingman, right? Create another product that's bigger and better that most people won't need. But if someone bought it, you would be happy to do that work too, right? You'd be really delighted if they bought the thing. You would be surprised how many times you make the wingman thing that's bigger, that you think is way more than anybody wants. And people go, amazing. I didn't even know. Like, yes, I want that big thing. So make sure, if you don't want to do a lot of handholding, it's not like you built a lot of that into this process, you're going to hate. So then if you start high, right, and say, well, there's this, you know, this thing is $75,000 and it's got this and this and like all these shiny objects on it. And then, you know, we also have this $55,000 option, which is great. And most people go this way, hurting again, right? Most people go this. And I think that's a really great value for you. And we also have, you know, a lesser option if that was something, you know, that you were needing to look at. But like, how does that sound? Does that seem like something you want to move forward with? You know, when we started at 75, 55, you know, feels a lot more reasonable in that setup. And so again, the high anchor, making sure that we're not, and we go in that reverse order, like start high and make something bigger than whatever the best offer is.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that. When you were saying that, I was thinking about, there was someone that told me once about how you have, you sort of create those anchors. So if you used to go into a hotel, say for over here, we've got like Premier Inns or Travel Lodges, which are kind of like, you know, that sort of real cheap kind of night thing. They're fine, but they're kind of, you know, that level sort of thing. If that's your, that's your basis of where you are, and then you spend an evening in the Hyatt or something like that, or you know, the, you know, that kind of thing, the Hilton or something, the comparison between the first one and the second one is so much different now, because you have a different, you have a different experience, different idea, you have a different place that you're comparing it to. And a lot of times people fail to have the comparison when it comes to things like that, understanding pricing and value and stuff, is they don't know what things should cost or shouldn't cost. So having some kind of comparison generally seems to help. But I like what you said there about anchoring first with a higher option and then sort of almost going down from there. Yeah. So from that, what do you see mistake wise things that people make from a pricing perspective?
Yeah. So definitely, you know, starting low, right, is a mistake, and having that, and knowing on a value side, you know, if you're a value business, there's a little bit of showcasing the greatest deal to get someone in, but make sure you offer, you like, that thing is actually reasonable and available and whatnot. So not being thoughtful to that overarching experience. Another thing that we get is where, if you're trying to get people to go from like A to double Z, we're not thinking about all the steps in between. It can make it to where it's confusing and you're maybe asking for too much stuff because you're thinking about where you want them to be 5 years from now, and are like way overloading that podcast. Initial moment of somebody podcast, just like
highly appreciated
feeling out if they're even interested. Journey, and you know, it's
Elements Brand Management on YouTube,
the thing we hear all the time, right, of like, you know, it's the blind date and you're asking them to marry you sort of deal, right? So we don't want to go too extreme in that. And this like ties back a bit to just how our brains even work, and something that's really foundational for people to know, which is we humans, research shows, we make 35,000 decisions a day on average. 35,000 decisions we're each making every single day. And if we assume everybody's getting 8 hours of sleep, which I know I'm being generous for many of us, that would mean you're making a little bit over 2 decisions per second, right? We're just like constantly making these little choices. And it's not like breathe in, breathe out. These are like real choices that we're making. The bulk of those are done subconsciously and using rules, predictability. And that's the concepts of behavioral economics are what those decisions are based on, right? The rules that the brain is most likely to use to make some of these many, many, many choices. So the problem when we sit down and we are thinking about pricing, we're thinking about a new product launch, we're thinking about experience, we're not thinking in micro moments, micro decisions, that little point where we could lose somebody. We're thinking about like, hey, we're going to send out a direct mail postcard as part of this and people will buy from it or they won't. And we'll put the QR code on it and we'll know if it came from this, like good for us, next on the list, right? But there are a lot of little moments in there, right? Of you need them to like receive the postcard. They need to be interested enough to not throw it away and to read a little bit of detail, to turn it over, to then scan the QR code, go to the website, not get distracted by Instagram, click through some buttons, read more, put something in the cart. Like there are all these little points that you need to be thinking about in how you're going to be either nudging them in the right direction or you're inadvertently kind of pushing them away. And if you aren't thoughtful about those tiny moments, you could be losing a lot of people that were otherwise interested and just got distracted or the process was cumbersome. And then if you get them to a form, which is asking like, how long have you been in your current role and how many people live in your household? And like, have you done this type of work before and blah, 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 and go, ugh, like, I'll deal with that later, you know. But those were questions you were asking that you might need 2 years from now, right? Or once they're down the line. So I always say to people, if you need to know what you want someone to do in this moment. And if you only get one thing in each of those little micro moments, what's the most important thing? What's the least amount you can say and do and show to get them to that next point? And then stop, right? That's what you want. And then do the next point and the next, but you know, less really is more in that case.
Yeah, that is, I've been through many of those forms where you kind of get like War and Peace.
Why are you asking me this, right? Like, and I had one recently where it was like, do you want to attend the, like, we're doing a webinar of something to talk about whatever, like come hear us brag about ourselves for an hour, but I was interested to kind of see what the topic was. And again, it was like, 3 or 4 pages worth of questions they wanted me to answer to attend their, what I'm sure would have been a very sales promotion heavy webinar. And you're like, no way. I'm out.
Especially in like in the era of kind of data privacy and stuff, like giving an email away is kind of like what, $10, $15 in itself. And kind of, if you think about it, what you're trying to do there and what you're giving away, because you know, you're going to get something back and it's going to continue to come through. So you kind of, to just to do that, but then let alone to give away everything else about yourself, what you've ever liked, your favorite TV programs, all this sort of stuff. It's just, it's too much.
Right. Yes. What was it? And then they, you know, it's like, why are you asking me about my grandmother's maiden name? This feels a little bit spammy, sketchy for sure.
Definitely. Yeah. What's your memorable password? Yeah. That kind of stuff. Yeah. Cool. So, is there anybody that you've noticed that has been done a really good job when it comes to utilizing behavioral economics or and pricing? But like it could be a brand that you've worked with. It could be a brand that you've seen. What kind of brands do you really, really good job with that?
I love looking at all the different examples of things, of what people are doing. I've obviously already talked about Costco. I think they do a really, really great job on the value side. And there are multiple examples in the book for sure. I have a couple case studies that are throughout and one at the end that is specifically, I think Hermes and the Birkin bag specifically is a very interesting setup that they have. So for those who aren't familiar with high-end bags, the Birkin is one that you can't just buy. You can't just go and get. And they have a special, like a couple that come out every year, and it, whatever the color is going to be, the size is going to be, there's no choice on it. And people get onto, it used to be that you would be on a waiting list, which was multiple years to be on, to be offered the chance to get a bag. So one of the things I like about the Birkin example is we often think, you know, with our best customers or we want the excitement about the thing. And then it's like, we're going to give them the thing for free at the end, right? And that we're going to cater to their every whim and desire and make them this, like, you finally made it to us creating this custom item for you. No, right? So if you get selected for that Birkin bag, you now have the privilege to buy a $10,000 handbag that's, you don't get to pick the size, you don't get to pick the color. If it's a color you hate, if you're like, oh man, I hate yellow and I really hope when it's my turn, it's not yellow and that's what you get, you like decide that you now love yellow, right? And you're going to revamp to be able to have this bag. And what they've done over time is it's actually evolved that it's not even the waitlist in that way. You have to now buy enough other stuff from Hermes, have a good enough relationship with the sales associate, that they get to nominate a certain number of people. They get to choose who gets the right to buy a Birkin that season, that year. And so this piece of like, you have to care enough about the brand, be involved enough, and buy our other stuff to have the right to buy this really expensive thing. I just love the idea of how that even works. And if you're a real big jerk and are like, you know, tossing your wealth around or whatever and being rude to the staff, then like, you don't get it, right? You're not in, and we don't promote that around here. Now, I'm sure there are some people that slip through the cracks and aren't the nicest or whatnot, but in general, this idea that you only get to be nominated if you have someone that likes you enough in here to give you this value to then pay us a whole bunch of money for a bag is genius. I love it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've got a business mentor who talks about something to do with the sales process and actually not making people do things, but obviously go through the process of almost qualifying themselves to a point. And that was interesting what you're saying there, because it reminded me of that. And the fact that, and what we were talking about earlier on, the funny thing with that is they go through all, you go through all that hardship to get this bag, but then you probably value it 10, 100, 200, 1,000 times more because you've gone through that hardship, because it's the scarcity is there compared to if you just had it on sale, you could get it whenever you wanted to, exactly the same bag. And I find that fascinating, the fact that you can actually, it can add, it almost perceivably adds more value to it.
Oh, yeah.
Having that process in place. Is there any sort of thing that people can do themselves to kind of implement some of those ideas into how they set things up from a product or service perspective?
Yeah. So the framework that I use for pricing is the same one I have for change management and what your employees need and can't tell you, but it's got six categories, essentially places that we want to be thoughtful to when you're building out your own kind of pricing strategy here. So it's called the It's Not About the Cookie framework. But we have first piece of it being priming, which we talked about a little bit. I know I mentioned the term at least, but it's something that's like drawing you in. It's the scent of the cookies, right? That get you excited, paying attention, wanting to be a part of this thing. We also have framing, that how you say something matters more than what you're saying. So being thoughtful to how you talk about different things, how you're positioning it. Again, you don't talk about with the Serendipity 3 grilled cheese sandwich. You don't say like there's, you know, chunks of metal in the bread, right? But like 23 karat gold flex feels very different in the way that it framed, right? That's a different aspect there. So being thoughtful to how you say it. We also have an aspect of loss aversion. So we humans don't like to give things up. We like to have our things. So there's FOMO pieces within there of being loss averse, having this also like visualizing yourself in the new state so you don't want to give that up, right? So in a service-based business, that can be about like, imagine how much easier, like think about how much time you're just like investing, draining yourself, doing your own accounting. Like imagine what your days would be like if you didn't even have to think about that. Like what's that worth to you? Like I now I'm feeling that. I feel the value of it. And then you say, for just $1,500 a month, like I can just take care of all that for you. You can live that dream. Like, does that feel like something you want to move forward with? The just is a framing thing here too, right? For just $1,500 a month, I could do that for you. Feels easy, right? Then you go, well, yeah, like, man, I could make up $1,500. Yes. Take this away from me. I don't want to do it. Easy to buy in, right? And I've now envisioned it and I don't want to go back to this terrible life where I'm up until midnight every night dealing with stupid numbers that I don't want to do, right? So we've got our priming, framing, loss aversion. We also have herding and social proof, right? So that like most people like this, testimonials, people like you do these things and love working with us, star ratings. This is the most popular product, all that sort of stuff. That's really important in there. We also have reciprocity, giving a little bit of something to make people want to give back to us. So, you know, free episodes of podcasts, free worksheet or a lead magnet or something that's going to be attractive to people, insider tips and insights or whatever it is. There are things you can be sharing. It's a little sample kind of there up front. giving generously. And the last one, which you mentioned, was scarcity and using scarcity in the right way. And so there are actually four different types of scarcity, which you can learn about in the book. One of them, you know, so on the deals side, though, right, if you're value, we have the today only type, which we see a lot of. But then you think on the quality side, like we were saying, there are only five of these in the world because of whatever, like it's exclusive for some reason, like, the, you know, the, those are some clear points where, like I said at the beginning, deciding whether you're quality or value, these six pieces of the It's Not About the Cookie framework, every business should be working on, but how you apply them is different, whether you're quality or value. So knowing that, to make sure you apply all those things in the right way, is really key to make it so everything falls into place when you go and present those choices to make it easy for someone to buy the right thing.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to go and read the bit about scarcity now. You kind of got me hooked on it. So on that note, where can people find more about yourself and what you do?
Well, thank you so much for asking. So of course, you can go to thebrainybusiness.com to learn more about myself, consulting, the books, the podcast. And we do have a special for everyone in that reciprocity vein for all your listeners, that if they go to thebrainybusiness.com/unifiedbrand, all as one word, can check out and get, you know, a first chapter of any of my books for free to see if it's a fit for you, if you like it, and that kind of try before you buy. And of course, all the books are on Amazon and anywhere else. And you can find me on all the socials as The Brainy Biz, B-I-Z, and as Melina Palmer on LinkedIn.
Cool. Well, I'll put all the links in the show notes, and I highly recommend everyone to go and check it out. Thanks again for coming on. It's been awesome. I wish we could do another one, because it's just, there's so much that comes out of these, which is great. So thank you very much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.